If profits are up at the big banks,
then are they ready to start lending again?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, October 17th.
Well, coming up, wireless telecoms are going to have to take the shock out of your phone bill.
Some hotels are ready to dump those tiny little shampoo bottles for good.
Wow. And speaking of the bathtub, there's a new product for the sidewalk that's like one of those rubber mats you step on in a bathtub, huh?
Those stories and much more ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
Citigroup reported a $3.8 billion quarterly profit this morning, thanks to fewer losses from bad loans and less money being set aside to handle losses. Meanwhile, Wells Fargo, which has a bigger focus on consumer banking, reported a $3.9 billion profit.
So what does that mean for you and me? Well, for answers, let's bring in our regular Monday guest, Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, bank earnings up. We've got another couple this morning. What does that mean for ordinary people who want to get a loan on a mortgage or for a small business?
Well, if you look through the details, the results are just okay. Banks are actually having a tougher time making money and growing revenues. So, unfortunately, I think that what it means is that credit standards are probably going to stay pretty tight for a while. It doesn't look like it's going to ease up anytime soon.
But when people hear about $3, $4 billion profits and they know that these banks are sitting on a lot of cash, they've got access to cheap money from the Fed, they're going to say, why aren't they lending?
Well, so we have a bit of a chicken and egg situation. We want to, after the financial crisis, we want to move to a world with smaller banks, with more tightly regulated banks. So that means that banks have to set aside more of their earnings to shore up their capital position so that they're safer. And what that means is that there's going to be less of that money available for lending. And of course, banks know they're under tighter scrutiny about the kinds of loans that they make. So in the process of moving to a world of tighter regulation, that by definition means less free money around.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
To Washington now, and the Senate, of course, has voted to not allow a vote on President Obama's jobs package. The focus is on passing individual elements of that plan. And today the president will push lawmakers to do so while touring North Carolina by bus. And as Marketplace's David Gura reports, he's likely to get a couple of very different views of the economy in the Tar Heel state.
There are really two North Carolinas. One's what's called the Research Triangle, home to tech companies and universities. And for the most part, it's doing fine. Patrick Conway is an economist at UNC Chapel Hill.
It's when you step outside that rather limited central area that you find greater difficulties.
Eastern North Carolina is farm country, and the western part of the state has been transformed.
North Carolina was the state with the highest rate of manufacturing employment right up until the mid-1990s.
President Obama will visit rural Wilkes County. It was once a hotbed of furniture factories and textile mills.
Obviously, over the years, a lot of that has declined, although we're seeing some come back.
Jeff Gartzka heads the Economic Development Corporation there. Within a decade, unemployment jumped from 2% to 12%. Earlier this year, President Obama visited a successful new chip maker in Durham. That's 150 miles away and a world apart from Wilkes County. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now to the world of cell phones, where we're going to get some treatment today for what you might call bill shock.
Bill shock.
That's the condition you experience when you get a bill that ends up being way more expensive than you thought it would.
I think we've all had one of those.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, today, the wireless industry is rolling out some new billing practices. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins us to explain. Good morning.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what are the wireless carriers going to be doing?
Well, over the next year, we'll start getting text or voicemail warnings whenever we're about to go over our monthly limit. So this would be for music and movie downloads, texts, also international roaming charges. The service is going to be free and automatic. You won't have to sign up for it especially. And it'll warn you in real time when you're about to be charged for more megabytes of data. That's as opposed to being delayed until you're already in overtime and then you're paying a surcharge for it.
So a little bit of a warning here. Why are they doing this?
Well, the FCC had already proposed regulations, and the companies don't like being strong-armed by government, so they came forward with this voluntary agreement instead. Hmm. And the FCC says this is a big problem. They've been tracking it. Tens of millions of consumers get these overage charges, sometimes for thousands of dollars in a single month. Maggie Reardon writes a consumer column at CNET.
You know, it's not like when you talk on the phone and you say, oh, I was on that phone call for 30 minutes. If you're downloading a movie or you're sending email or you're going to Facebook, you don't necessarily know how much data that's using and how much you've eaten up of your plan.
And Reardon says there's actually help out there for people who don't want to wait for the cell phone company to deliver the bad news about your plan. Several apps can actually help you track your data usage.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Thanks, Mitchell.
You're welcome.
A big natural gas pipeline deal is in the works. Kinder Morgan says it's going to pay $21 billion for El Paso Corporation to create America's biggest pipeline operator.
Well, from natural gas to oil, the British oil giant BP says Anadarko Petroleum will pay $4 billion to settle all claims between the two resulting from the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Anadarko owned part of the rig that exploded in the Gulf, and the money will be put toward that $20 billion payout fund.
Check out the numbers anytime at our website. We're at marketplace.org. You can follow us on Twitter, too. We're at Marketplace Radio. I am at Radio Chio.
And I am at Jeremy Hobson.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with two free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. G20 finance ministers met in Paris over the weekend, and they came up with a plan for European leaders to come up with some sort of credible idea to solve the debt crisis in 1 week. Reporter Christopher Worth has more from London.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner left the meeting saying Europe's plan has all the right elements, but he essentially said the devil will be in the details. That includes how to magnify the strength of the bailout fund from roughly $600 billion now to what some reports indicate could be somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 trillion. Geithner favors using the power of the European Central Bank to backstop European banks and limit the damage from bad Greek debt. But Carsten Brzeski of ING says European leaders aren't willing to go that far.
If you had the firepower of the ECB, it would probably be the most convincing instrument. But right now, I think there is still so much opposition from the ECB, from the German government, to allow it.
Another option being discussed is giving a bigger role to the International Monetary Fund. Whatever the plan looks like in the end, the most important thing is whether the financial markets see it as going far enough. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
In China, two top executives at Walmart have stepped down, including the CEO of Walmart China. The resignations come a week after authorities in one Chinese city closed several Walmart stores for food labeling violations. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports reaction is mixed over there on whether Walmart deserved the punishment or whether the government is unfairly targeting the retailer.
The city of Chongqing, population 32 million, has 13 Walmart stores. Every one of them was shut down for mislabeling pork as organic. Political analysts called the crackdown politically motivated. Chongqing's party chief will likely be promoted to China's top leadership next year, and its hacking a foreign company usually garners public support in China. Business analysts disagree.
China's been arresting both executives of Chinese companies as well as foreign companies. So this is not just a foreign attack.
Sean Ryan is the author of the book The End of Cheap China, Ryan says Walmart's been sloppy in China. Its biggest mistake, he says, is the company hasn't changed its strategy for China. Walmart recently reported a quarterly loss at its 350 stores there.
Western brands cannot compete with Chinese companies on price. It doesn't work. Chinese companies will always be able to be cheaper.
Analysts in China say Walmart should switch gears and focus on wealthy consumers. With two top positions in China now vacant, now might be the time to do that. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, it's fall, the season that conjures up images of crunching leaves, baking apple pies, Steve, your favorite things, and for many people under 18, preparing to take the SAT or other standardized tests.
The ACT, absolutely. I remember those. With the increasing competitiveness in getting into college, not to mention, of course, the looming job market 4 years or more down the line, America's tutoring industry is booming. And here to talk about America's tutoring industrial complex, yes, there is one, in our Marketplace Midday Extra is Missy Sullivan, senior editor for Smart Money Magazine. Hey, Missy.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for being with us today. I guess the first question is, why is tutoring today different than it was, say, 10 years ago to warrant such growth?
Oh, there are a couple of things going on with tutoring today. One is you can now find a tutor online the way that you can find a date online. You go and you put in your zip code and you put in the subject that you want, and then, you know, anywhere from a dozen to hundreds of tutors come up. So there's a lot more availability and access than there used to be. Used to be, you know, you'd have to get it off a tab at the grocery store. You'd have to sidle up to somebody on the soccer field and ask them, you know, who's your tutor?
Well, do these tutors get paid a lot of money, or what's the going rate?
The going rate ranges quite widely, $20 up to $795 an hour.
Wow.
The sweet spot is
$795 an hour.
Yep, in certain, we call that limousine tutoring, right?
What are they teaching you for that kind of money?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, what you get for that is, you know, PhDs with JDs and all kinds of degrees who are, you know, master tutors. And the company that actually charges that makes an interesting point. They said, you know, teachers and tutors, folks who are teaching your kids, they are undervalued and underpaid, and they ought to be paid more.
So, Missy, who are these people? I mean, why are they getting into this kind of work?
Tutors come from a wide background. You've got traditionally, you know, moonlighting teachers. That's where, you know, kind of starts. And then you've got a lot of students, graduate students who are trying to pay their bills. And more recently, you've got folks who are just out of school all the way up to almost retired who are unemployed and looking to fill in the gap in their cash flow.
Does this say something about the education system that perhaps it's lacking, and therefore we need this extra help to get people prepared?
The school system is definitely overwhelmed. You've got 5% of the kids in the school system have learning disabilities, and of those, a staggering 2/3 are 3 grade levels behind.
Wow.
So you've got that from the get-go. Then you've got all those kids with ADD, and, you know, that's, like, unmeasurable, right? And those kids are the ones who need not just, you know, subject tutoring because on a one-on-one basis, because they can, you know, they have a hard time focusing in a big class with a lot of noise, a lot of kids, but they also can really benefit from some of the extra stuff that's happening in the tutoring world now. They're teaching study skills. They're teaching time management, some of those soft skills that help students just have the basic, you know, the basics to be successful as a student.
And does this go back to the issue basically that we're seeing in this new economy, which is that you really can't survive unless you've got a good education, or you at least have much better job prospects if you've got a college degree, maybe even a master's degree?
Sure. It's not just about remedial work anymore. It's not just about catching up, although that's a big part of it. Right now, a lot of the tutoring industry is being driven by folks who want to, you know, raise that grade from the B+ to the A- up to the A+. They feel that their kids cannot get into college unless they're strong across the board. It used to be you could be strong in one thing, weak in another. Now you've got to be, you know, A's all across the board.
What kind of advice would you give someone who's looking for a tutor?
The first thing that you want to do, you can do a couple of things. You can go online. You can also find companies locally that have a stable of tutors. You want to make sure that wherever you go, that there's a background check. I mean, these are your kids you're talking about, a criminal background check. The second thing you want to do is you want to make sure that you get 2 references at least, and get references that have results. What are the grades? What are the test scores? And then lastly, try them out for a session or two. Don't make a long-term commitment.
Missy Sullivan, senior editor for Smart Money magazine. Missy, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Now to a letter that's going up for auction next month in London. It was written, Steve, by Paul McCartney.
Ah.
Sir Paul.
Sir Paul McCartney.
Back in August of 1960. Now, this is before the Beatles really blew up, but it was asking a drummer to audition to be the drummer for the Beatles.
Yeah.
This is, of course, pre-Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
The name of the drummer is not on the letter, so we don't exactly know what happened to him. And I guess we can only hope, Steve, that this song was not written about him.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
Oh, man.
To poor little drummer, you know. I hope he's not a nowhere man.
Knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you and me? Nowhere man, please listen.
Well, Steve, a lot of industries have done a lot of changing over the last several decades, but here's one that has not, really. Hotels.
Yeah.
If you think about it, you're getting the same experience today, basically, that you were 30 years ago. You've got a bed, a TV, a dresser, little Bible in the drawer, tiny shampoo bottles in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Although that one apparently is about to change.
The tiny shampoo bottles, really.
Here is Marketplace's Adrian Hill with the story.
It can be frustrating in a hotel shower not to have enough shampoo left in that little tiny bottle. You shake and cajole in an effort to squeeze out just a little bit more. But not at the high-end SLS Hotel in Beverly Hills, where they've stocked the shower with full-size bottles.
Which really allows you to go completely crazy and soap yourself as much and as often as you want to from head to toe.
Tomas Medding is the general manager there. You can tell he's good at what he does by the very next line out of his mouth.
Or not at all. It's really entirely up to you.
Medding says the hotel uses big bottles because they want to create more of a residential feel. Plus, they reduce waste, which is something a whole lot of hotels are aiming to do, both upmarket and downmarket. Michelle Millar is a professor at the University of San Francisco. She says those tiny plastic bottles create extra work for housekeeping. They create a whole lot of trash and can cost more than the alternatives. But getting rid of them is tough. It's hard to come up with an alternative that visitors will like. With big bottles?
Consumers are still a little bit hesitant with the big bottles because of sanitary reasons or what's in those bottles or did anybody tamper with them.
And with the other primary option, those wall-mounted soap dispensers.
Consumers have been really reluctant to use those. I think it reminds them of going to the gym.
They see it sort of like truck stop bathroom dispensers.
Consultant Brandon Kennard says those perceptions could change in time with a good education program, kind of like the tags you see about saving water by not replacing towels.
You could put a little sign on the soap that says, hey, we're saving 10,000 bottles of plastic from going into the landfill by using these dispensers. We hope you like them.
Or maybe it'll take more people realizing how fun it is to go lather crazy with all the soap they could possibly use. Or not. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Well, whatever kind of shampoo you use in the hotel room, know this. There will always be more hair to wash because just 2 weeks from today, Jeremy, on October 31st, the United Nations says the world's population will top 7 billion.
I can't believe we're hitting that fast.
I remember. I think it was 1998. We topped 6 billion, and here we are at 7 billion in just a couple of weeks from now. The majority of growth has come from countries in Africa, along with places such as Afghanistan and Pakistan, some parts of Southeast Asia. But some countries are not growing like they used to. And that's the subject of our quiz this morning from Stefan Richter at theglobalist.com. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Steve. Ready for today's quiz?
I am ready.
In 1950, the global fertility rate was 5 children per woman.
All right.
At that time, not a single country in the world had a birth rate below 2 children per woman, which is what's called the replenishment rate.
Right.
At this time, how many countries have a fertility rate of less than 2 children per woman, meaning that they don't keep their own population at a stable level? Just one, Japan. B, a dozen or so in Europe. The third one is 25, and all of them would be in developed countries, or is it over 60 countries these days?
I would say of less than 2 children per woman, I would say D, over 60.
You are becoming a great quiz answer master, and I have to study up and come up with tougher ones. You're absolutely on target.
Yeah, I will tell you, Stefan, I will tell you how I know that, though, because I remember certainly European countries are not procreating as much as they used to, and here in the United States as well.
But you know what the good news is? This trend is going to continue into the future as we hear all about, you know, moving towards 7 billion of the global population level. Forecasts of the UN Population Division are that by 2030, so just in another 20 or so years, 86 countries will be below replacement level, and importantly, it will be such countries as China, Brazil, Indonesia, and Russia.
Yeah.
A few large countries are still blowing up the global population, namely India, Nigeria,
That's
Pakistan,
right.
and the Philippines. You know, we are making some progress in terms of history to move down to a more stable population level. So there's some good news in that and less stress on global resources and all the like.
And on our way to 7 billion people very soon.
You and me and all the rest.
And all the rest. All right, Stefan Richter from The Globalist. Stefan, thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, the economy might be in the tank, Jeremy, for a lot of companies. But there's one firm in Australia that's been, well, seen quite a bounce lately, if you will. Sales at A1 Rubber are up 35%.
Oh, a bounce.
Yeah, did you get that? Since 2005. And they're building warehouses all over the place, all over Australia anyway. And you ask yourself the question, why this surge at A1 Rubber? Well, at first, the company made rubber sidewalk matting made from recycled tires, which is nice because we need to recycle
tires. I like walking
tires,
around on those rubber sidewalks anyway. Yeah. They're kind of fun.
These are for bars and restaurants. Yeah, it's a little bounce and to soften the sound of beer kegs clanging on the sidewalks. They wanted
to quiet
those big, heavy, you know, those beer kegs that you'd have to roll or try and carry. But now many of those same pubs are buying the matting to save those who overindulge from hurting themselves. So if they fall down, they're not going to, like, split their head open or something like that.
They'll never learn their lesson if that's the case.
They're installing it, this matting, outside these clubs, on the sidewalks, and inside the clubs, too, around the dance floor. That's pretty sad. If you can't dance, if you're really that bad, maybe you should just, you know,
find a new hobby.
Find a new hobby or sit this one out.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your day. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.